When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello everyone and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous, infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me as always, Brian Reese.
That's me. Hey Paul, what's going on?
Not much at all. It's a very wet and rainy day.
Yes, I think we're on our 73rd straight day of rain, so this has been fantastic. I'm making that number up, but it's not off by that much.
I was going to say, that's beyond arc building time.
Well, it's that weird rain where it's like, you know, I mean, it'll rain for like 5 minutes. Should we talk about the weather? Should we talk about the government?
I think we're going to do a little bit of both in this comic that we're going to do today.
Hey, this is true. Yes, there is. We have nature and politics.
Yes.
Or not politics so much as government.
Yes, there is actually some politics in here. So if you're the kind of person who doesn't like politics in their comics, you might want to skip this one. But today on the program, the 2003 Vertigo series, The Losers, written by Andy Diggle with art by Jock. And in case you're curious, yes, every time I say the name Jock, I'm going to say it as Jock.
Oddly enough, not an athlete. Well, I shouldn't say that for certain. I mean, he could be very athletic. I've not met him in person nor followed any of his extracurricular activities. So,
I'm sure he's a strapping young man.
Yes.
Okay. Also, side note, before we begin, I want to let you guys know, if you go to our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, you will find a brand new page called Resources, in which I will be posting the collected editions we are reading from on every episode.
Ooh.
Yes. And then there's also going to be links to Amazon if you would like to purchase those things. The reason for this is we are now Amazon affiliates. So if you follow the link and buy it at no additional cost to you, we get a kickback of a few cents here and there. And that goes towards upkeep of the show, hosting costs and whatnot. So if you'd like to give us a little helping hand, click on a link and buy something. That'd be awesome.
Yes. I'm going to go buy a bunch of stuff right now.
Yes, but you buying stuff really doesn't help us.
Oh, right.
But yeah, but by all means. But now, before we talk about The Losers, there is something going on in the world of comics that we'd like to talk about. And that is that DC announced that Joe Hill will be starting a new pop-up line of whatever that means.
Because they're not doing imprints anymore.
Yeah, it's a pop-up line.
They're doing pop-up line. They're pop-ups, not imprints.
I would love it if there was a comic that was actually a pop-up that would, you know, like little stuff comes out of it.
I think they call those pop-up books.
Exactly. So anyway, this pop-up line will be a limited series of horror comics called Hill House Comics, and this will be part of the Black Label imprint that will be apparently taking the place of Vertigo.
And what's fascinating is, if you look at the covers,
it looks very Vertigo-ish.
They sure as heck look like they're Vertigo titles.
They're Vertigo-y.
The trade dress is similar. The sort of imagery and art style is similar as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, Vertigo kind of got its start as a horror imprint, or focusing on horror.
Yes. So, and here, you know, everything that's old is new again.
And an imprint, start a pop-up.
Yeah, I still don't get the whole pop-up thing. But Hill is probably best known for Lock and Key, although he's pretty prolific.
Like his dad.
Like his dad, who is Stephen King, of course. Yes. Everyone knows that.
Everyone does know that. People know this thing.
All right, behind the scenes, people. I had forgotten that, and Brian had to remind me of it. So here we are. Anyway, he'll be writing two of the, there'll be five miniseries that'll be released through Hill House Comics, and he'll be writing two of them. Basket Full of Heads, which is a great title.
Yes.
With art by Leo Max.
Leo Max, yeah. Leo Max. No idea who that is.
I don't either, actually. And Plunge, with an artist to be named later. The other comics that have been announced are The Dollhouse Family, written by Mike Carey and illustrated by Peter Gross.
I'm very excited about that just because it's Mike Carey and Peter Gross.
Right. So yeah, that's the team. The Lolo Woods, written by Carmen Maria Machado and illustrated by Danny. Hey, Danny, what's up? How's it going? I am unfamiliar with Danny. Unless he's Danny Torrance. Also, there will be a series called Daphne Byrne, written by Laura Marks and illustrated by Kelly Jones. All of these look really good.
They do. And, the Daphne Byrne, Kelly Jones, of course, is made for horror comics. Yeah. I love Kelly Jones's art, and it, of course, his Batman, his stuff he's done with Batman has been, you know, the very sort of exaggerated, dark, the exaggerated sort of horror art that he does with those has always been great. So I think that's a great fit.
Yes, I agree. So like I said, all of these look great. Joe Hill will also be contributing a regular feature called Sea Dogs, which will kind of be a backup strip that will appear in each one of the series, which is an interesting idea to have kind of a recurring thing.
It's a good way to get people to buy all the comics.
Yes, it is. Anyway, it's
not to be cynical on the matter.
No, but it's how they used to do it in the old days. So
right.
So like I said, this all looks really good. And, Hill has given some interviews where he has referenced movies like Hereditary and Get Out and various others, Conjuring Universe and so forth, as a renaissance in horror. And he wants to add to that and continue it and contribute to it. And I'm on board for that 100% because I too think that in the last few years, it's been a pretty stellar movement that's been going on. Horror has just been, there's been kind of a horror renaissance that's been going on.
Oh, sure. And I mean, it's very interesting that where this is ending up, like at DC, because reading about this and the information about it, it's just the first thing I thought of reading this was like, this sounds like Dark Horse. I mean that like I'm surprised this didn't end up at Dark Horse.
Okay.
Because Dark Horse has kind of been the leader of horror comics for a good while now. So,
yeah, that's true. That's right.
So to me, it was like, I read this and I was like, I'm surprised that DC got this and it didn't, it seems like Dark Horse would have been the first pitch, but who knows? And maybe he pitched it to numerous places and was pleasantly surprised when DC said, sure, come on aboard. You know, and it's very interesting that DC is doing this. I made the joke earlier about how, we've talked about this before, how they got rid of Vertigo and now they're slimming all their lines down to just like DC Black Label and I think DC Kids or something like that, although they're throwing in young adult titles in with kids. But they're basically, getting rid of their imprints just months after they had announced a whole bunch of new imprints.
Well, you reach a certain age and you feel like you need to slim down a little bit. But as far as this is concerned, I mean, there, like I was mentioned, the horror renaissance. I mean, there's been you're not a particularly big on the whole horror genre.
I appreciate it. It's not, I don't gravitate towards it. There are titles like I'm very interested in these titles.
Yeah.
And I will read horror comics now and again, but it's not my primary, purchase, not my primary push.
Well,
it's weird because I love, that said, of course, Hellblazer remains one of my favorite, series of all time, which is, smack dab into the horror genre. But I'm sorry, yeah. Go ahead.
That gets into exactly the exact point I was going to make, which is what I like from horror. I don't like just gore and guts and torture porn, that kind of thing. There are people who really enjoy that. That's fine. It's all good. That's just not what I like from it. I like horror that's more suspenseful and more where there's an emphasis on, using horror as a metaphor or an allegory for various ideas. Like for instance, in recent stuff, there's like Get Out was used as an allegory for race, but it was also pretty darn scary.
Right.
Oddly enough, there was a film recently in the Annabelle series, Annabelle Creation, which dealt heavily with disability And I was, you know, I was not expecting that at all. It's like, oh, wow, some thoughtful, thoughtful horror going in here. And that's what I like. I like using that, you know, I like it to be suspenseful and scary and stuff, but using that as a way to discuss other subjects. Hellblazer did that great as well, whether it be politics or violence or whatever the storyline happened to be.
Religion,
exactly.
Yeah, but, you know, and sci-fi is also, it does that as well. It's a,
oh, well, yeah, exactly, yeah. And fantasy, when it's done well, does the same thing.
You know, these so-called, marginalized, genres that get separated out in bookstores and categorized in folks' minds as well as...
Yeah, I could go off on a whole rant about that.
Right, well, we both could.
Yeah.
Particularly based on places we've worked in the past.
Exactly.
But it's always, you know, all of these genres get marginalized and some of the best writing and some of the most interesting concepts have come out of these particular genres. So, it's nice when one of the major two, one of the big two publishers, comic book publishers, one of them is making an actual push to feature horror once again. I think is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I agree. And I'd love to see that new, that more modern style of horror that's kind of prevalent right now. But I'd also like to see it combined with sort of like an EC style.
Right.
And yeah, so that's what it looks like to me.
Oh, I mean, there's a couple other, like, is it Vault? I think Vault is, I don't know if you're familiar with Vault. It's kind of a minor publisher at the moment, but...
Vault has one of my favorite series running right now, which is These Savage Shores.
Yeah, but I think Vault really styles themselves after EC in some ways. In your experience, does that track with you?
To a certain extent, yes. It's kind of hard to say because, you know, the style of art is more modern, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But they're trying to do more anthology things, which is what EC used to be known for. What this looks like, this Hill House, looks to be as if they're going to go for that old EC style of artwork combined with Vertigo, which I think is really interesting. It's exciting to me. I'm looking at it thinking, wow, this could be something really special. Now,
yeah.
I've read not one word of this. I've only seen covers and given descriptions, but...
I mean, I think Kelly Jones, like I mentioned before, Kelly Jones is perfectly suited to that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, like, and I'm not familiar with these. I don't know. TBA is an artist I'm certainly not familiar with.
I believe it's pronounced Tubba.
Tubba. Okay. obviously Tubba has done a lot of art and writing over, 60, 70, 80 plus years.
He is everywhere, including, just in every genre, in every publisher. He's everywhere.
Very prolific and surprisingly still alive after all these years.
But yes, I mean, and you know, you combine him with Ibid and everywhere.
Yeah. But Peter Gross, I like Peter Gross's art a lot. I'm not sure how that works in an EC style, but that could be interesting to see. Well, you know, I'm happy to see this and I'm certainly going to check them all out. I'm curious what the sales threshold will be for them.
It'll probably be pretty big at first.
Yeah, but I mean, it's
a big push. But you know, it's as if they can continue and sustain it.
Right. I mean, DC hasn't been as axe heavy as Marvel when sales are.
But in these stories, I bet they are going to be pretty axe heavy with a real axe. But I think they're going to be bloody good, and it's scary how well they're going to sell. Help me out here.
No, I'm horrified by this whole discussion.
There you go.
This gives me chills.
Exactly. There you go. It's awesome. Should we wrap this up?
I think we should. But I think both of us give this attempt. I give this attempt a very hearty thumbs up.
Oh, absolutely. I'm looking forward to this. This is I find this very exciting. I remember a couple years ago now when the Sandman universe was announced. And I was like, this is kind of, I was kind of excited for that, but I just thought it would kind of be a rehash of old things. This looks like something new and exciting, and I'm much more excited for this.
And I would just also like to say, because I'm sure either Joe Hill, Dan Didio, or Stephen King, or probably all three of them are listening to this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And I would like to suggest to all three of them that they think about possibly adding, if this is successful enough, maybe doing a Jonah Hex Western horror series under this pop-up.
I'm not opposed to that at all. All right. Let's take a break. We'll plug someone we like, and when we come back, we'll talk losers.
And we'll talk about comics as well.
There you go.
Adventures into the unknown.
Tales from the Crypt.
Skeleton Hand.
The Haunt of Fear.
The Vault of Horror.
Adventures into Terror.
Strange Tales.
Uncanny Tales.
Journey into Mystery.
The House of Secrets.
The House of Mystery.
The Phantom Stranger.
Dr. 13.
Doorway to Nightmare.
The Witching Hour.
Strange Suspense Stories.
Worlds of Fear.
Chamber of Chills.
Terror Tales.
The Beyond.
Tomb of Terror.
Weird War Tales.
The Twilight Zone.
Creepy.
Dark Shadows.
Vampirella.
The Haunted Tank.
The Heap.
Eerie.
Swamp Thing.
Weird Mysteries.
Tomb of Dracula.
Tales of the Unexpected.
Werewolf by Night.
The Demon.
Man Thing.
Monster of Frankenstein.
Brother Voodoo.
The Son of Satan.
Night Force.
The Living Mummy.
The Sandman.
Tomb of Darkness.
Evil Ernie.
Saga of the Swamp Thing.
Flinch.
Hellblazer.
30 Days of Night.
Preacher.
The Walking Dead.
What do these titles have in common? All of them. From Adventures into the Unknown, to Tales from the Crypt, to The House of Mystery, to The Tomb of Dracula, may be found in the Long Box of Darkness. I'm your host, Herman Lowe. Join me every Monday night for a journey into comic book horror as we delve into the secrets of the Long Box of Darkness.
So listen if you dare, puny mortals, to the Long Box of Darkness, available on Stitcher, iTunes, and Podbean. And check out the blog at www.longboxofdarkness.com. Good night, and pleasant screams.
And we're back. And so today, Paul, I believe we are discussing your recommendation this week. You want to tell us what that is and tell us a little bit about it?
I sure will. And it goes like this. The Losers were a World War II commando unit created more or less in 1969. And got an ongoing feature in 1970 that focused on the group's bad luck and portrayed them as antiheroes. In 2003, Andy Diggle updated the concept to a modern setting, all but jettisoning the original concept, but keeping the antihero angle. The Vertigo series focuses on a group of elite special ops soldiers wrongly accused of a crime and forced to prove their innocence using their particular set of skills to uncover a nefarious plot. Basically, it's the A-Team if the A-Team swore profusely and killed people. Book 1 covers two storylines, Ante Up and Double Down, in which we get to know the characters. We learn of their situation and a little bit of how and why they've been put on a kill list for what they've seen. And we learn the lengths they will go to uncover the conspiracy surrounding that situation and who the mysterious figure of Max is that's pulling the strings. Each character is a specialist in some way, Clay is the leader, Jensen is the hacker, Cougar is the sniper, Pooch is the pilot, and Aisha is the loose cannon that just might get us killed if she doesn't end up saving our asses. They begin as stereotypes, but go beyond the stereotype into fully realized individuals. So we get to know them and care about them as the plot unfolds and the depth and breadth of the conspiracy becomes clear. The Losers is a combination of crime heist, international espionage, covert military ops, and conspiracy theory, rolled into a fast-paced thriller told with snappy dialogue and rendered in stylized art that is both beautiful and brutal. Told with humor and cynicism, The Losers is a classic post-9/11 action comic that takes familiar genre tropes and adds a few little twists and turns, creating something unique and new. Brian, what did you think of The Losers?
Well, I just thought it was a hell of a lot of fun, Paul. This is, once again, I feel like we say this all the time, but often we're recommending stuff that, for obvious reasons, we have read in the past. But I think you may do what I do, which is recommending stuff we read a while back and kind of want to revisit. And so we're revisiting it. We're using the podcast as an excuse to revisit comics we want to go back and reread anyway.
Oh, absolutely. This is definitely an excuse to just... to just relive old memories, basically.
Yeah. And so, of course, I was reading this as it came out. I have not gone back at all to reread this since the series ended. So, again, as ever, this was a lot of fun to go back and reread. And to be honest, one of the things I did, I desperately wanted to read the second half of this series, and I have not on purpose, because I didn't want to have that in my mind when we were discussing this first part of it, because there's a lot of secrets and left to be told and revelations to be revealed. So I'm kind of on tenterhooks a little bit to find out what happened, you know, to remind myself how this ended.
Well, yeah, like one of the big, at the end of this volume, we don't know who Max is.
Right. We still don't know who Max is. And I have a vague memory that I think I know. I think I remember, but I'm not sure. Memory does that. But I think one of the great things about this series is, which you touched on your intro, there are whole segments of each issue that are just incredible high-paced action, which could come right out of like a late 60s through the 70s, you know, those great action films like Bullet and French Connection. I'm speaking of two car race, two films that feature car races prominently, but it just really reminded me of, you know, it's not gratuitous, it's not excessive, it's not, you know, that god-awful Fast and Furious stuff, but it's got this real noirish 70s feel to the action sequences. I don't know if you caught that. That just really excited me as I was reading it. My eyes were just bouncing all over the page, kind of watching in a good way, kind of absorbingly, like these action sequences that you know, kudos to Jock, who is of course an artist of great renown on so many projects, but here, you know,
I agree. He's really in his element here, and the way that the action scenes are paced and how the characters move, it's really well done. And in fact, what you were saying about those early 70s, late 60s action films, like The Italian Job and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Where, you know, that is how it's paced, but it has an updated feel. Like, so it's kind of like post 9/11 Bond, you know, so you have these really great action pieces, but it's also, he twists it in such a way, both Diggle and Jock do that in such a way that they're taking familiar genre tropes, but they're giving it a little extra twist, a little extra spin on it to make it something, to make it their own, basically.
Well, and it's certainly, I don't mean to make it sound like it's, I mean, it's certainly very contemporary for the time, you know.
I agree. But I think that's exactly what they were doing. I think that's what they were pulling from, you know, especially since the original Losers, like the main feature of the Losers was taking place in the early 70s. But to speak to your point, if you read the introduction to this, it mentions both Three Kings and Kelly's Heroes.
Yeah.
Now, I think that's perfect, though, because Three Kings is a modern, you know, post 9/11 action heist, basically. But then Kelly's Heroes is that 1970s wartime action heist. And that's a perfect combination of what's going on here.
And one of these things, so I love, absolutely love heist movies. They're some of my favorite types of films. And you know, at the end of the day, again, to touch on what you kind of already stated, but I mean, this is basically, at least the part that we read, is just a series of heists.
Oh, yeah.
It's just one heist after another. And one of the things I love is that Deagle does not waste a lot of time going over the details of the heist. You know, you run into that problem once in a while with like heist stuff where films and books and or comics where a lot of, you basically have the heist laid out. You have all these scenes of, you know, setting up the heist and explaining what they're going to do. And which I sometimes feel like takes away from, you know, watching the actual heist as it happens. And, you know, Deagle here, he doesn't really have much preamble to the heist.
No, you're absolutely right. When you see that stuff in movies and in novels or whatever, they set up the heist so that we know when something goes wrong.
Right.
What that wrong thing is.
Yes.
It is kind of hand-holding us through the whole thing. Deagle doesn't care about that. He just says, here's the heist, and when something goes wrong, we know it because usually someone gets shot in the head.
You go,
that wasn't supposed to happen.
Or we have a potty word dropped into the...
Yeah. Or a volcano explodes. I appreciate that fact as well, where, like I said, he doesn't handhold you. You just kind of go through it, and the action is unfolding. And by the dialogue, you know, when someone says, hey, this isn't how it's supposed to go, you kind of pick up on the fact that, hey, that wasn't how it's supposed to go. And that makes it much more fun for us, because I love the way he just drips and drabs, just gives us little information.
Like, and it's because a heist isn't really a heist until something goes wrong. And it, you know, if, and so, you know, it, you're allowed to be surprised when it does. You know, it's going to go wrong, but it's up to you to figure out at what point it goes wrong rather than being told.
And the exciting part is having the characters figure out a way to get out of the thing that just went wrong.
Which again, often involves shooting people in the head.
Exactly.
Or throwing them into an airplane motor.
Oh, that was brutal, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So let's get into some details.
Okay.
Yeah, I made a joke about it, but they actually do reference the A-Team in the comic. And that's exactly what this setup is. It's the A-Team, except people don't crawl out of the cars when they crash.
Yeah. I mean, I had, at various points, I think I had the A-Team theme song going in my head. Dun, dun, dun,
dun. So we get the setup of this is a special ops team recruited by the CIA doing some nefarious stuff, and something happens. We're not told in this volume what exactly happened, but something happened where they were not on board with it. So there's many allusions to they made their own call in the field.
Right.
This gets them put on a kill list, and this team has to go underground for a while, and now they're back trying to... This is the thing. They're just trying to clear their own names so that they can get back to their regular lives. They're not trying to take anybody down, at least at first. They basically just want to blackmail people into saying, don't kill us and let us go back.
Essentially trying to gather information, intel to be used against Max and whoever else was involved to basically say, you know, it's an intel gathering mission. Actually, all three of the major missions in this arc are essentially done for intel.
Yeah, exactly. And I do appreciate the fact they're not trying to be heroic. They're just trying to save their own asses. Now, eventually they do become heroic in a roundabout way.
And there's discussion about that too. There's I had written down that revenge versus justice is a strong theme.
Yeah, definitely a motif that's running through the whole thing. So that's it. This basically is a series of heists, a little bit of a middle bit where there's some downtime, literally called downtime, where we get to know each of the characters, their backstories and some of their home lives. Most of the story is just, you know, going from one heist to another. Now, the first one, they have to steal a truck off of the Baranzano Bridge, which is pretty amazing, actually. We get thrown right into it. First of all, that's the thing. We get thrown right into the middle of them planning a heist.
Well, the best part is the first heist isn't the box in the truck, it's the plane. So there's actually, I take it there's four heists.
We basically just go from heist to heist to heist, and every single time they are slowly piecing together a bigger and bigger plan or bigger conspiracy. The more they become involved in it, the more they realize, oh, this isn't as simple as we thought it was going to be.
And that's where they run into some of the moral and ethical questions as to, you know, why are we doing this? And a lot of the characters at various points, you know, say, hey, I just want to get my name. You know, Pooch just wants to get their name cleared so he can go back to his family, you know, his wife and kids.
Exactly. You know,
and so the sort of the leader, Clay, gets questioned as to whether he, how much of this is him trying to clear their name and how much of this is him trying to have a larger social agenda.
Yes.
You know, is he a social justice warrior?
But it is alluded to, because in the original Losers, there was Sergeant Clay. So it's kind of assumed that he is a descendant, either a son or grandson. No, it actually has to be grandson, because he does say at one point, my grandfather died fighting the Axis, who were just following orders. So he wasn't going to just follow orders, which is, you know, a pretty blatant political statement right there.
Yes.
Yeah.
It should be noted that Andy Diggle is a British writer. So he's bringing his own unique take as he's discussing, you know, sort of U.S. foreign policy.
Which is interesting right there, because he also goes to great pains to make sure, because Clay at one point is called a traitor.
Right.
And he said, no, I am not a traitor. I'm not betraying my country. I'm fighting to stop the people who are betraying the country.
Right.
You know, which is it's not subtle, but it's an interesting angle to look at it.
I mean, there's not much in this that's subtle.
No, absolutely not.
And again, that's not a critique.
Yeah.
Or not a negative critique.
Yeah. It would be very easy for a story like this to just be, these guys are anti-America, or, you know, because America seemingly betrayed them, that they're going to fight against the government. But that's not really what they want to do.
Right.
They reinforce it over and over and over again, that we are patriotic, we are Americans, and we're fighting for the ideal of America rather than this corruption of it. And it should be, you know, there's a, I'm reluctant to call it conspiracy theory, but it's a, you know, it's using a lot of real history, because the Iran-Contra did smuggle drugs in order to get weapons. And that's basically what's happening here.
So they reference that, and they also tie it into, you know, the conspiracy or true theory of, you know, the CIA dumping, you know, cocaine and developing crack and whatnot, and dumping it into the streets of, you know, New York and LA and places like that, and using that money to then fund more nefarious schemes like international schemes and whatnot.
It's a horrible cycle that goes on. And again, see, it's the thing about the losers themselves is they're not necessarily against that. They just don't want to be part of it themselves. Well, you know, maybe
they're not opposed to it. They just don't want to do it. Yeah,
exactly. So it's a minor distinction, but it is a distinction nonetheless. You know, and again, as the story progresses, and you know how deep this goes, and the people who are being hurt by it come to the forefront, you find them becoming much more, like you said, first it was revenge, and then they become more honorable. I don't want to say they become honorable; they become more honorable.
They each character has their own different moral center. I think I shouldn't say moral, because I guess I should say like ethical or center.
They have their own motivations,
right? Not all of them come to the same conclusion as to why they're doing the things they do, but while they all may differ on the why, they don't differ on the need to do.
Exactly. To everything we were just saying. The character of Aisha, who is a refugee from the Afghan war, she brings an entirely different mindset to this team, because she's not, how do I put it? She's fighting for something completely different than what the other men on the team are fighting for. She is really fighting for revenge and her own form of justice.
Right. She's a freedom fighter.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Who is also tenuously connected to the agency, which hasn't been completely explained yet in this first half that we have read for our purposes today. So, you know, I mean, we're left, she's introduced as someone who may not be completely trustworthy.
See, she's introduced as someone who is not trustworthy, and yet she is portrayed as the most trustworthy of them all.
Because she's the one that ends up bailing their asses out all the time.
Exactly. Now, I use that sort of cliched phrase of, she's going to get us all killed unless she saves us first.
Right.
You know, it's so well done that, you know, the heist is going along swimmingly, and then she just sort of pops in out of nowhere doing something completely different. You just watch all the characters going, oh no, what's happening now? But it's usually something what she's doing is usually the right thing to do. But I don't know about you, I think she becomes the most sympathetic character throughout the whole storyline. Sympathetic isn't the word. Maybe it's I found myself rooting for her to succeed more than some of the others. I mean, as great as Jensen is, and he's a lot of fun, but I'm not rooting for him. I'm just sort of like, I'm enjoying his antics.
Right.
Whereas Aisha, I'm thinking, I want her to succeed. I want her to, you know, to end up okay, basically. Well, right. She's had such a bad background and she's such a badass. You just want her to do well, you know?
I hope the Stone Cold Killer does well.
It's a morally gray area. I understand that.
Yeah, I mean, Cougar also has, you've got the two Stone Cold Killers, and one is Aisha, the other one is Cougar. And he's kind of, so in this first half, you mentioned that there's a two-issue kind of arc splitting up the two halves of what we read today. It's the downtime, and it like you said, it kind of humanizes some of them and gives a little bit of their history and what have you. And Cougar is problematic to me in some ways. You had mentioned in your intro about how, like, these characters are kind of stereotypes. Mm-hmm. They're genre stereotypes, and they very much are. Absolutely. And you're right that they develop beyond those. But thus far, Cougar's, I think, the trickiest one. Because, I mean, he's basically Wolverine.
That's true.
You know, he doesn't say much. You know, he's the strong, silent type. He's the sniper, right? So he's the loner, because all snipers are loners. You know, we never see his face because he has his hat pulled down over top of his face. So in that, he's Snake Eyes. And we're supposed to feel for him, like, you know, they show, like, during the downtime, they show him he's in Mexico and he's seeing the ghosts of his past. Right. And of course, you know, as a sniper, you don't kill someone face to face, you kill them from afar, which I'm sure has something to do with all of that. But even his story in this particular part of it, his story isn't very well developed. They're basically just like, hey, this mysterious guy who's the sniper, who's the cool one. All we get is, like, you know, during his downtime period, we're told that he has ghosts. Oh, you know, and he's haunted by his past. And it's like, well, duh.
Well, he's been blowing people away. I mean, it's just a series of headshots over and over again.
Right. Like, he's kind of the antithesis of Aisha, where, you know, the two kind of main killers are, she's got this really developed story that we're rooting for, and then the character that's supposed to be the badass one, you know, or what have you, it's the one character that I didn't develop any sort of interest in.
I don't necessarily disagree with the fact that he's the least developed. At the same time, I do, you know, I like the fact that he's the quiet type who just kills people and goes about his business. He's not out there speechifying and making a bold statement. He just does his job and just keeps his head down,
literally. But it just doesn't instill, like you said, like, Jensen is the comic relief. And of course, because he's the comic relief because he's the hacker, and the hacker must always be the comic relief. But, you know, you're right. He's hilarious.
He really is hilarious.
He's got his own character quirks that set him apart from a more generic reading of that type of character.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that I really appreciated. One is, in order to hack into a hard drive, and he knows it's going to take a while, he strips down to his underwear and puts on a pirate hat. I think that's just so wildly strange thing to do.
And then at some point, Clay's talking to him, and he's like, while he's doing that, I think it's Clay, the leader that he's talking to on the phone or what have you. And Clay is like, are you hacking in your underwear again? And he says, you know, no, I'm wearing a hat.
Yeah. The other thing I really appreciated, as far as just, it's just a really funny scene, and it's a great pun. When he can't actually get into a computer, he picks up an axe and hacks it until he can get the hard drive out. That's brilliant. He actually physically hacks the computer.
Yep.
Yes, I read that and just laughed out loud and said, this is fantastic. But yes, Jensen, he's sort of the front and center kind of character. Because everyone else is so damn serious and focused, you need something like that to make this bearable, or would just be oppressive the entire time.
Right. I mean, you always need, and it's a fine line to walk, and some writers do it well, some writers don't. I think Andy Diggle does it very well. Yeah. So, and, you know, I mean, Pooch is a very sympathetic character due to, you know, Pooch just wants to get home to his family. And, you know, he's got that great scene during the downtime where he does meet up briefly with his family. You know, you just see, like, when that is ruined for him through no fault of his own, you just see, like, the sadness there.
I do like the fact, yes, he's betrayed by his brother, his wife's brother, his brother-in-law. That's what it is. I'll get there in the end. He's betrayed by his brother-in-law. And that's actually a very well-written scene as well, or a very funny scene as well, where his brother just lays it out to him and gives him the speech about how you're a bad man and you've left your family. And Pooch just laughs and says, oh, okay, you have no idea what you're talking about. Thanks for the...
Right.
Yeah.
The brother asks him if he's a drug dealer.
Yeah. You have no clue what you're talking about. So that's really, and how these are stereotypes and these are genre tropes, and I think it's very incredibly intentional. It's, mm-hmm. And they're leaning hard into them. And again, it's not like I'm going to subvert them and pull the rug out from under it. No, they lean into these stereotypes. They give it a little twist and they give it a little.
Well, and stereotypes exist in genre pieces for a reason. So
exactly. Well, the very first scene we get, so they're trying to steal a plane and you're introduced to each one of the characters just through dialogue. And because we know who these are, you know, we already know what the genre trope is. We already know the stereotype. So we understand who every one of these characters is. And, you know, it's shorthand for us to know, okay, now I'm in the scene. I don't have to sit here and spend, you're the hacker, you're the pilot, you're the sniper.
We don't need pages and pages of introduction on it.
Exactly. In the very first page, we know who everyone is, what their role is. Let's get on with the action. And the action is fantastic.
It certainly does.
Yes. And the action is fantastic. I really appreciate the fact that it just leans heavily into what we're going to do is have a fast-paced action story. All the plot stuff and the conspiracy stuff is fantastic. And it's a nice, and as the plot unfolds, it's really great to piece all this together. It's an interesting mystery. But mostly, it's just flat-out action. And it's wonderful. You can tell a good writer from a bad one when they're using stereotypes, but it fits the action, which is what Diggle does. Mm-hmm. It fits the action. It fits the story. He uses them well. It's sort of shorthand to get us right in. We understand what's happening and we move on. But then there's the other side of the coin, which you just use them because you can't be bothered to come up with a new character.
Right.
And it's used as a crutch rather than a starting point.
I think they all work very well, except for there's what, like I said, there's the one I have reservations about, but I think the rest of them clearly rise above will still be the necessary trope as well. So
should we get into some details?
Sure.
The first thing that I noticed, and they establish it right away, the story goes to great pains to establish who can and can't be killed. They give you the whole backstory on Parsec, the security people, for instance. That's one. And they say, these are really bad people. And it's just a way for Diggle and Jock to say, okay.
Right. Okay, now I know what you're talking about. Yeah, okay. Sorry, yeah. Go ahead.
Say, like, because, you know, you don't want your heroes to be seen as villains and just randomly killing people. But they very much establish, okay, these people, they're bad. They can be killed. That way there could be tons of bloodshed without besmirching the character of our heroes.
Whereas security guards are off limits. You know, exactly. Just random security guards like earning a paycheck.
Exactly. But special ops guys, oh, we can bomb them from above and it's perfectly fine. But it's very well done how the rules are established in this world. These are the people who are the pawns. These are the people who were the innocents, and these are the really bad special ops people, and we can kill
them if necessary.
Yes, and every once in a while, I mean, it doesn't always play by that. I mean, I should make some interesting choices about who she kills, which she gets called out for multiple times. But for the most part, they're really trying to establish that they're anti-heroes, but you know, you're not meant to think they're vicious killers because they're killing people who should be dead, which.
They're killing the right people.
Yeah, exactly. Again, morally gray area, but It's all there. So I should say, before I forget, gay whales against racism.
I wrote that down in my notes as well.
I don't even know what that means. It's fantastic.
Credit to Jock or the letterer.
Yeah, we judged that at one point there's a protest set up by the losers in order to, as a distraction for them to get in with their heist. And yeah. One of the two people actually are holding.
Yeah, there were two signs.
There were two signs. Gay whales against racism.
Which is something I think we all could get behind.
I think so. In all seriousness, there is something that is established in the fact that there are stakes here. In a story like this, you don't expect the main crew to be killed or get hurt. In this particular story arc, I mean, the characters do get hurt and they do fail, which it adds to the, I don't want to say reality because this isn't like, it's hyper reality.
Right.
But it is, and again, it's established early, the rules of the game here. Yes, these are our main characters, but they can be hurt and they can be killed.
And they can betray.
And they can be, and they can be the villains. And that adds such a dynamic to the story as you're reading it, because you never know. Is someone going to die? Is someone going to betray the team?
Right. There's no guarantee. There's, you don't feel like nobody is safe.
Exactly.
Which is both, slightly harrowing when you're reading but also refreshing. I mean, when in superhero comics, you pretty much know Superman is safe. And if he's not, if he's going to die, well, you would have found that out long before because it would have leaked or it would have been advertised. The event would have been advertised as, say, the death of Superman. It should be noted that I don't know if clearly stated ahead of time. This is a Vertigo comic. We should.
Well, we've mentioned.
Kudos to Vertigo. You may have mentioned, but that's what was always so refreshing about, the titles that are outside of sort of mainstream comics, particularly creator-owned characters, that made Vertigo so great and makes Image so great now and some of the other publishers is the writer can do whatever the heck they want with their characters, and Andy Diggle in The Losers, I don't remember who lives or dies, but I'm guessing that not everybody gets out of this alive. Again, I don't remember going back to this, but God pity, all the Saga readers out there who get attached to a character.
See, that's another thing that defies what your expectations are. And I don't want to get sidetracked in the Saga, which is what I was about to do. But that's the impressive thing here is that I keep coming back to this, that he establishes the rules very early. This is what the world is. This is who can be killed. And if they go outside those boundaries, then you're not supposed to like them anymore. And he also establishes that, not everybody's going to make it out alive. Not everybody's going to make it out healthy. And once those rules are established, boom, off to the races. And it's just furiously paced story full of really dynamic action. So as always, I mean, there's so much minutia we could go into, but overall, this is just just an exciting action story that it really needs to be seen to be, we can talk about it till the end of from now until the end of time. But unless you're seeing how the scenes play out and how the characters interact with what they're doing, it's not really doing it justice. Just suffice to say that this is just a really exciting comic book.
Yeah, it's fun. And anybody who likes or has even a passing interest in this particular style or genre, if you haven't read this yet, it's way up there in terms of quality and in terms of the sort of excitement you get when you read this type of story, and definitely should be on any fan's list of faves, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And you said it right at the top where it's a noir story, it's a early 70s action thriller, all that combined with the modern aesthetics of a post 9/11.
With all of the conspiracy and political intrigue, just layered and layers of political intrigue.
Yeah.
Definitely contemporary political intrigue.
Absolutely. It's highly recommended for me. This is the kind of story that makes me say, I'm going to miss Vertigo, because this is what made Vertigo great, being able to give us stories like this. Highly recommended. And you can always go to our website and follow the link to buy the paperback or the trade paperback if you want to. I got to keep plugging that.
As you should.
Yes. So next time on an all-new edition of the Collected Edition, Brian, what are we going to be reading next time?
Well, we're gonna keep a little bit in the same sort of discussion of the usual gang of idiots or what have you. For next time, we are going to be reading, and this has nothing whatsoever to do with any potential TV shows coming up on Amazon Prime or whatnot. This is completely random. Our next entry into the collected edition will be issues 1 through 14 of Garth Ennis and Derek Robertson's The Boys.
You're in Chicago. Shouldn't it be Da Boys?
Da Boys. Da Boys. The Bears.
Yeah. No, I do like the fact that you're pulling a little synergy here.
I know. I don't usually do this type of thing.
I know. I'm so excited.
It really wasn't intentional, but then after thinking about it, you know, because it's been on our radar for a while, I think, and we haven't done Ennis yet.
Yeah, we've been talking about doing a Garth Ennis story for quite a while.
And I think the boys, especially once you recommended The Losers, I was like, let's do the opposite of The Losers.
Yeah. so it's a nice companion piece as well.
Yeah, The Boys is a very controversial piece, and Garth Ennis brings... I think The Boys out-preachers Preacher by a good stretch.
Ooh, let's save that thought for the conversation.
So this is probably, will it be a not safe for work NC-17 discussion and reading?
Yeah.
So we're gonna dive into The Boys,
which is an interesting thing to say.
It is.
All right. So cool. I'm excited to read that again. So that does it for this episode of the collected edition. I hope we weren't too scattered on this one. I felt like we were kind of all over the board, but I think we got
kind of our thing.
Yeah, it really kind of is. We staked out that territory of not being coherent.
Structure.
Structure, the hell. Anyway, everybody, thank you for listening. Please leave us a comment. You can always go to our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where you can leave comments on individual episodes, or send us an email to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com, or go to Twitter @CollectedEdPod, that's CollectedEdPod, and just let us know what you think. That would be awesome. Otherwise, I guess that's it. Thanks everybody for listening, and keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @CollectedEdPod. That's Collected, E-D-P-O-D. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
Vertigo series, The Losers, by Andy Diggle with... What was that?
Sorry, that was... I turned my volume up. I didn't realize it was going to do that.
It's like an angel came down. Let's try that again, shall we?
Let's. Hold on, you may need to cut this. Isn't Joe Hill Stephen King's son? You threw me off.
Right. No, that's right. He changed his last name because his actual real name was Joe King.
Yeah. You threw me off there for a second, and
I had forgotten.
I started looking it up. I was like, I was certain Joe Hill was Stephen King's son.
Yeah, I had forgotten all about that, actually. All right. I'm cutting all this and making it sound like we're smart.
Well, one of us was.